struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect. I'm Travis Johnson here today with Lewis Cheney from GetToTheDamnPoint.com. Before we jump into the show, hop on over to the Nonprofit Architect Alliance, sign up, become part of our mastermind, grow with your peers, get the people together that you can learn from that have been in the industry, that know what they're doing, and make yourself part of a stronger nonprofit. Lewis, how are you doing today?
Man, I am doing great. Sheltering inside, you know, it's a joy. Truly, it's a joy. Don't you know?
I feel like we just talked yesterday, and don't you know is definitely a phrase from my neck of the wood up in northern Minnesota. Have you been up that way?
No, I've never made it up to Minnesota. There's some areas out there that I haven't made it into, but you know, I tell people that I'm from Kentucky. Yes, I do wear shoes. Yes, I do have teeth. Of course, I always tell everybody the old joke that the toothbrush was invented in Kentucky, because had it been invented anywhere else, it had been called a teeth brush. So I get all those out of the way right off the top so people ignore the fact that I'm from Kentucky. So I understand.
Whatever you can do to distract them. I'm actually wearing my bourbon shirt that I got on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail 2 years ago. My absolute favorite road trip with some guys that are friends of mine. Fantastic time on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail with stories I can tell for hours and stories that I probably shouldn't repeat based on the law finding out.
Let's not do that. You know, I don't think there's some things I want to see, like, you know, your picture somewhere in a post office or anything like that. So we'll just stay out of all of that.
No kidding. But you did this great TED talk. It's like, well, you won't die from public speaking, but your deal might. What on earth are you getting at with a title like that?
It's really simple. It's about getting your message out. And if you don't get your message out and it's not clear and it's not concise and it's not to the damn point, you clutter things. And as you clutter things, people aren't paying attention to you anymore. Everybody think about it. Think about that time you went into that PowerPoint. Guy gets up there, has this PowerPoint that's basically like, you know, his family vacation. And he stands there and reads everything. At some point, you're looking at him and going, get to the damn point. And your deal is going off the table because people are not interested anymore. There's ways to get in there and get to the point. That way you're getting what you want heard and not wasting time and not losing your deal.
That's so important. And when we say deal in the business world, we talk about mergers, acquisitions, new product lines, new partnerships. In the nonprofit world, that might be sponsorships. That might be donations. That might be someone that's willing to promote your cause on a trade basis, trading services. And now you get up there and you don't sound like you have a clue about what it is that you do or who you support. If you don't know what you do in a clear, concise format, something like helping you build a stronger nonprofit, or I'll get you your next $30,000 in donations, nice, clear, succinct lines that convey that you know what you're talking about, what you're really working for, they're not going to listen.
I'll tell you what, one of the things I've told people, and I've said this a lot to people, is the worst thing you can ever say is, I'll wing it. If you're going in to try to present, for example, talking about people in the nonprofit world, if they're going in, they're trying to talk to some people who can help them with the two lifebloods they need, which is money and volunteers. If they go in and they try to wing it and they drift off over here, it's sort of like reading Stephen King. I love Stephen King, but here's the thing about reading it. You start here and you go over here for 400 pages, then you come back. Then you go over here for 400 pages, then you come back. It's kind of like that. You need to be more direct in that. And that's what I'm talking about. If you get in there and you don't get that across, it's not just the line, but it's how to present what you're talking about, which involves so many other things we'll get into. But you're exactly right. You've got to have that message in your head before you walk in. Don't walk in and wing it.
Now, share with our audience what your background is and how you came up with this get to the damn point mentality and where that really took hold for you.
Spent a lot of time working in television news. I have a very long career in that. That's where I started off. I've worked in entertainment news, working with country music artists, famous people. I've worked all from everybody from the homeless to the rich and the famous. And the thing about it is, we had a certain amount of time to tell a story. If you watch a news story, they have about a minute and a half to tell a story. That's what we had. So you didn't have the luxury of dragging this out. The only time we drug any pieces out, so to speak, is when they did what's called sweeps pieces. the ones with series pieces where you had maybe 5 minutes to tell a story. But 5 minutes, if you think about it, really is not a long time either. But in the world of television, a minute and a half is what we had. So we had to get in, boil it down to its essentials. It's not a magazine. It's not a newspaper spread. You had to get in. You had to get out. And it's kind of like movies. They tell you a scene only exists because it's there to give the information it's supposed to. They say in a movie, you come in late and you get out early. And that's exactly what I'm looking at, the way that I approach this and teaching people about speaking.
When you talk about those little sound bites, that little minute and a half you might have online, if we look at the social media world, that's Twitter at 140 characters. We're now at 280, but at 140, you don't have enough room to mess around. You said your words, you got to the damn point, and the tweet's out and done, and there's no going back.
The other side of that, so you got a converse issue there, though, too. The world has been brought up, and I've got kids who are 24 and 20. This is how they talk. It's like this.
With their text.
Being able to do that. And sometimes it's going to take a little more than 280 to get in than it would be the 140. But you're right. If you're doing it in a very short period of time, it's got to be super concise to get across. And that's hard. It's not as easy as you think it is. I mean, a lot of people think, well, I can just spit something out. You can, but is it your best? And essentially that is what a soundbite is. It's the cream of the crop, the moment. Let me share something with you about that. Let me tell you this little story. If I can get off on a tangent here with you. I sent a crew one time to interview a lady who was the coroner for Vandenberg County, Indiana. This lady had spent more time in classes on safe sleep for children than anybody I've ever met in my life or heard of since. She knew everything there was about keeping an infant safe, about not sleeping when you're co-sleeping with a child. Sent a crew in to her. Now, this is a lady that could have turned around and pulled up a board and talked about, here's the stats of whatever, and here's what this is. And she could have quoted all sorts of sources, but she didn't. She simply said, put the baby in the bed, no blankets, no pillows, no bumper pad, no toys, nothing, just the baby, the mattress, and that's it. She said, and if you don't listen to me, you don't want to listen to me, go ahead, put those things in there, and I'll come get your baby. When a coroner says that, grabs you right here. I can't prove it, man. There's no way to prove it. But I would like to think that she saved lives that day because she said something in such a way that it just absolutely emotionally grabbed somebody. And that's the key. Getting people involved with you emotionally, stories particularly, that's where it's at. And she did this instead of doing a really long piece. She did it like that.
What I see on the news today when we have these doctors, these quote-unquote experts come on talking about COVID, disease spreading, all these things. They have the choice to be as succinct as that coroner was, or have the choice to ramble on. And I tell you, more and more of them choose to ramble on, and they have no real idea what they're going to say. If you want to get your message out, you might just have a moment or two, and that's it. That's true in the business world. That's true in news, entertainment, media. And that better believe that's true in the nonprofit world. You go to a networking event, you have no idea what you do, and you can't say it in a sentence or two. You're done. They're done listening. They've moved on. If you've got your mission statement halfway down your page, or it's a paragraph or two paragraphs long, no one's going to read it. They're not interested. Get to the damn point.
I'll tell you what's even more interesting there is I was talking to somebody in a nonprofit, and she said the problem with them is getting the volunteers, the people who are helping you, getting them to understand that, because anybody who's in your organization, I don't care if it's you're an entrepreneur or small business, large corporation, if you're in a nonprofit, doesn't matter what you're in, every single person on your team that works for you or is involved with you is an ambassador to your company. And they have to know how to do that and get that message across. I've seen it happen where they didn't. I've watched interviews where it didn't happen. Another reason why I'm doing this, I've been to those interviews where people are like struggling to come up with the words. And that's one of the things that I teach them in the course that I'm doing is teaching them how to find those words, nail them down, and be able to bring them back around so that when you're finished, the reporter who's doing your story, particularly if you're on a deadline, and we always were on a deadline, man, we raced the clock. They're going to grab. You and I were talking about before this about being first and being last. You want to go first because your message is remembered. You want to go last because that's where your message is remembered. Everybody in the middle sort of gets lost in the shuffle. Same thing in an interview. The top thing you say and the last thing you say when a reporter goes to run into the edit bay to cut your story, that's where they're going to hit. So make sure you punch it at the top and you punch it at the bottom. So it makes their job easy. The easier that you make it for them, the better you wind up coming off.
Oh, without a doubt. We spoke yesterday. It was our first meeting. We're already recording the podcast today, which I think is fantastic. But you gave me the opportunity to download a little helpful PDF, the costly business problem that no one ever notices and how to start fixing it. And roll us through the story of how this happened and what problem you discovered.
What I have discovered is something that I come from a Toastmasters background. I've done television news, then entertainment news, commercial production, independent film. That translated over into the speaking world with absolute ease. And it's one of those things I tell people, this is not a joke. When I was a kid, I had an uncle one time bet me a dollar I couldn't shut up for half an hour. I lost because I couldn't shut up for half an hour. So it was a natural for me to move into this. But when I started looking at this, I thought about writing a book. And one of the things that came up on this little sheet that I had for a publisher is, what do you do that's different or unique than what everybody else is out there doing? And my first thought was, I have not a damn clue what it is that I do that's different. And I had to think about where I'd really looked at. And I had it, I just didn't see it. And that is time. People think about speaking from the standpoint of, oh, it's got to be on stage. I'm presenting to an audience of 10,000 people and I have to hit the back row and it's about enunciation and it's about hitting back there. And it isn't. It's about anything. When you're in a meeting, it's communicating. And if you're not doing that in a way that gets people involved and isn't shorter, you're losing time. The example that I talk about in the ebook you're talking about, if you look at, say you have 50 employees and those employees make $25 an hour. And each employee is in a meeting for an hour a day, every day, 5 days a week. By the time the year is over with, you've spent over $300,000 on meetings with these people in those hours that are used up. That comes out to $20.83 a second. So when I talk about the ahs and the ums that I'm sure we're going to get into, and people go, oh, it's okay to have those in there. They add up. And I can show you that they add up. And as that adds up, you're losing money. You're also losing your message and you're losing productivity. That's what spawned the ebook.
So you define and detail an interview by a nonprofit that was having an interview on your news program, which is fantastic. And I know you absolutely want to talk about how you love nonprofits. But you dissected the audio and you stripped out all the ahs, ums, and all the filler words. And in that 6 minute chunk, 5 or 6 minute chunk, there was 37 seconds of ahs and ums. What does that do to productivity?
It destroys it. I mean, think about it this way. This lady was on there. This is a program. It was a midday show that she was on, which nowadays the midday shows often charge companies to go on there. Now, what happened in this case, I'm not sure if she was charged or not, but I can tell you they've started doing that now. So when you talk about time as money, which is a cliche in this case, it literally is time as money. But she was on, the whole interview lasted for just under 5 minutes. I edited it down and took out the host, leaving just this lady speaking. And this lady spoke for 3 minutes and 11 seconds. In 3 minutes and 11 seconds, she used over 70 of the filler words, things like, yeah, well, but, so, like. She used them so much, I listened to it and went, okay, what happens if I take out everything else? And I leave just this lady saying those words. And what I've created is 37 seconds of the most annoying thing you're ever going to listen to in your life. If people, you watched my TED Talk, you saw me play it on the TED Talk. I could see the audience going, okay, Lewis, we get your point. No, seriously, Lewis, we get, turn it off. Would you please turn that off now after about 10 or 15 seconds? Because it just, it's like nails on a chalkboard. Had she been talking for a full 6 minutes, just her, I mean, a full 30 minutes, just her, she'd have lost over 6 minutes of time. That's 6 minutes of message. What stories could you have gotten in that 6 minutes? What other examples or data or anything you could have gotten in there to help persuade people to your cause that you're losing simply on these? And that is the tip of the iceberg.
When I think of nonprofits that I've talked to offline, behind the scenes, call me up for a 30-minute call, and I ask them, what is your mission? I get a handful of filler words, which should be the most succinct thing that you know as a nonprofit should be your mission. Your mission, your vision, decide what it looks like for you and tell me. That should roll off the tongue of you, every board member, every volunteer, every employee, everyone that's championing your cause should be able to repeat that thing verbatim without any effort. It should be easy as taking that first breath in the morning when you wake up. Stretch it may be hard for some. you folks listen. Let's not be hasty here, but it should be second nature. It should be no problem whatsoever to say, this is my mission. This is who I care about. How can you support us?
You know what needs to come right after that, though? They do need to be able to say that, and it needs to be short. It doesn't need to be the prettiest of words. Sometimes it's not even the exact statement itself, but it's, what does that statement mean? What's the message of that statement? Let it be that. Let the heart of it show, particularly in the nonprofit world. And the next thing that should come out of their mouth is a story, because nonprofits, they have tons and tons of stories. And we're not talking about it has to be a 45-minute long diatribe. It could be something as short as the one I just told you about the lady who said the soundbite. But a story will make people do this. They're going to lean in. They're going to pay attention to you. And it's going to touch them. And everybody has those. You've got those. For people who are new to your organization, share those stories. Have them share any stories they run into. Keep a Rolodex of these things, man. Sort of an old term there, Rolodex, showing my age. Keep it in whatever electronic file you want to, but you want to keep up with those, because those things will come in so handy sometime. You won't even be thinking about it. Somebody will ask you a question at some networking event, or when you're speaking to some group, they may throw a question out, and all of a sudden that story will come forward.
It's funny that you mentioned Rolodex. I'm going to get off on a little side trail here. I've got a friend that absolutely loves vintage stores, and she was showing me pictures of some of the things she was looking at, and she was like, do you have any idea what this is? And it was, no kidding, a Rolodex filing system for addresses, phone numbers, and contact information. Just happened to me, no kidding, the other day, and I couldn't help but throw that in here.
Dude, I got to tell you, I had a reporter years ago. I've trained a lot of reporters and photojournalists over the years. We had a new reporter in when I was the assignments manager, and she couldn't find a phone number. She was looking for a phone number online, and she was like, I can't find this. And I tapped the phone book on her desk. It's like this thick, and said, have you looked in here? And she said, what's that? I'm like, oh, wow. Do I feel really old now? She has no idea what a phone book is, or never been shown one. I don't guess she just did not. She just didn't get it. It never clicked with her. Hey, there's a book with numbers in it here.
I think we could possibly derail into an entire episode on exactly what we're talking about, because I had two more stories popping in my head just while we were talking there. But we won't get there. I know that you spent a lot of time in TV news and doing national media. What is it about nonprofit stories that just impacts you differently when you're in the media?
For me personally, I'll tell you what it was. It was nothing but good news. When we're doing something for nonprofits, and I get sent out on a story, man, for a nonprofit, it made my day. Why? Because I'm doing something to get out the message of a nonprofit. That's the helpers who are helping others. Goes back to Fred Rogers. You know, I've talked about that before. Fred Rogers talking about always look for the helpers. After going and covering, you know, fires and murders and death and destruction and wrecks and everything else, I get handed a story where I get to go, and it's a shop with a cop, where they're going around and they're buying toys for people for Christmas, or it's the drives they do at Christmas time. Those are the ones that really get to me, because I go and I watch these big bins get filled at a Salvation Army. Then I go back and do that story later where that child gets that toy who otherwise wouldn't have gotten that toy had it not been for that particular nonprofit, the work that they do, and the people who support it. If it weren't for that, here's a child that I can't even imagine wakes up on Christmas Day and doesn't have anything. So when I have those kind of stories, how can you not fall in love with that? How can you not be moved by that and go, this is what's good for humanity? And that's what it did for me. It just lit me up to go to those things, man, because I got a chance to help. It was my part, tiny part that I got to play in helping them do a good job.
I love that. And when we talked yesterday, I had told you my background, my reason for doing what I'm doing, my why. And I've shared that in a few episodes recently. I won't get into that, but I really am doing this to help the helpers, the guests that I bring on that are experts in just a litany of fields between nonprofit work, fundraising, writing grants, how to operate a board, board governance, which is just the most riveting topic for people that excel and start up businesses. I had an episode with Ned Murray and we talked board governance, and it was fantastic. He completely nerded out on it, and I love Ned to death. But that's not just a topic you would be all over, just random bar conversation. Hey, do you want to talk about governance? No one signs up for that, right? No one. But then you bring in business leaders that talk about startup troubles and how to get into a CRM and how to run it as a business and all the same things that translate between businesses and nonprofits. And then we bring in someone like yourself that has a real niche that applies to anyone in the nonprofit space or the business startup space. And these episodes are just fantastic. I love them to death. I love getting this knowledge and information out there. And if honest, I'm being a little bit selfish because I get to interview these experts and have at least a few conversations with them where I get to ask all the questions that I want to know. Whether or not I share them with my audience is arbitrary, but I'm getting the learning that I need in addition to all the audiobooks and podcasts that I download on a regular basis. It's just wonderful. So when you get someone that you're coaching through something like public speaking, how do you help them get over the fears of what they're getting into?
You know, that's funny. I talk about this a lot. People go, what's your magic bullet for getting over fear? And that's the thing that a lot of people, when they talk about being a public speaker, and make no mistake, you heard me say it in the TED Talk, if you do anything where you're communicating with other people, you're a public speaker. If you're fundraising and you're having to go out in the community, guess what? You're public speaking. If you work in sales, you're an entrepreneur, you're trying to sell your business, guess what? You are a public speaker. There's so many different facets. If you're on the phone with people, you are a public speaker. That's the whole point of what I'm talking about, is you take this and you turn it so that people understand that. And then you understand I've got to do it. And guess what? There's no magic bullet for the fear. There's none. There's not one. It's just like anything else. And I tell people, this is the analogy that I use with them. When you first started to drive a car, unless you're raised on a farm in Kentucky, which does happen, I've seen it happen. If you're raised on a farm, it's a little bit different. So for those of you out there raised on a farm, I'm not knocking you at all. I'm just saying I've seen this happen. They can hop in a car at 16 and drive because they've been driving on the field since they were about 10. They can barely see over the dash. Whole different world. But typically speaking, if you are somebody who's starting off as a new driver, you didn't just hop in the car, turn on the key, and take off. No, what happened? You had to learn the rules of the road. You had to learn how to operate a car, understand the brakes and the gas are different things and have different functions. You know, I've been down that with both my kids. Sometimes that was a question. But anyway, I mean, I'm not kidding. I had a kid who wanted to turn left on a red light. Dad, you can turn left on a red light, right? He's heading for the red light, not slowing down. And I'm like, son. So you didn't just hop in and do that. You had to learn how to do it. It's the same thing here. But it'd been really great if somebody could have just almost plugged you into a lot of those tips and tricks. And that's what I'm trying to do, is plug so much information into them. It speeds them up in the process to be able to get their driver's license, so to speak.
See, that's fantastic. All the things that we cover in nonprofit worlds and entrepreneurial journeys, it's the same. It's a skill. There's no one that just hops out there and is fantastic at something. It just doesn't happen. If it does happen, it's because they've got background in many other areas where they've worked on something very similar, and the bridge there is much shorter. It's not like they're hopping in blindfolded. They have some kind of background in something. Like, I understand that basketball is a skill. I understand that I am terrible at basketball and that I will put no time to it. But I also don't need basketball in my life to reach nonprofits, to better the people that I'm around, to elevate others and provide value without expectation. I don't need basketball as a skill to do that. What I do need is the ability to ask questions and to actually listen and drive conversations where they need to go and provide tips, tricks, pointers, value, and insights to give people clarity and help them over the hump. Those are skills that I need. Basketball, I'm not built for basketball, let's just say. I'm more built like Gimli in Lord of the Rings, like I'm going to help you get through the dungeon. I'm short, I'm wide, not particularly coordinated, but I don't need to be. But if I focus on the skills that I do need to be successful, that I do need to work on, everything is going to get easier. When someone is lifting weights at the gym, they get stronger and stronger. The weights don't get lighter. The weight still weighs the same amount today, tomorrow, and forever. But due to exercising that muscle and getting stronger, that weight gets easier to lift. That load is easier to carry. And when you go on stage for the first time and you tell your personal story, surprise, it's going to be terrible. It's going to hit you with emotions you never thought you had before, or you're telling it in front of a family member or a spouse or a friend that didn't know the story, and you catch their eye and you see the horror on their face. And all of a sudden, you don't even remember where the heck you were yesterday for lunch. You forget all of that completely. You fall on your face. You get upset. You speed up your talk. You get off stage early as fast as you can. And then you realize there's no escaping the stage, and you have to go back and you have to tell your story again. But it's like holding on to a cactus. It's going to hurt while you're holding it, and it's going to be painful when you let it go. But it's not until you let it go that it starts healing.
Great analogy. You know, it's interesting you talk about that and how it can affect you from an emotional standpoint. I did a speech for a competition, and I was talking about a friend of mine who had recently passed at that point. And I had rehearsed it. I had worked that out. It was a competition speech for Toastmasters. And man, I was fine. I did it for the first time in front of my Toastmasters group, and it hit me out of the blue. I did not see it coming, and that sucker hit me like a train, because those stories that you tell can have those emotions in them, and you may have told it to other people that are you used to talking to. When you get out there and you talk to some strangers about it, or you talk to somebody you don't talk to a lot, and in my particular case, it was my people that I knew were going to support me, but it just came out of nowhere. And it's really not a bad thing when that happens. It doesn't mean you break down. It doesn't mean you lose everything. But it does show, especially in the nonprofit world, you're human. You're absolutely human. And you're working with other people. And man, it's just, I can't think of anything better than when I see somebody who's got a passion and an emotion and a fire for something. But passion will only take you so far. You can be very passionate. I consider to be passionate and talk to you about, hypothetically, you know, Lost in Space. It's a show that I loved as a kid. And after about 2 minutes, you're going to be going, I don't care anymore, Lewis. I really don't care about Dr. Smith and Lost in Space. So passion's only going to take you so far. You've got to have a connection with the audience, create what's called that Me Too moment, where when you're telling a story, it's universal. The thing that we talked about before, the coroner and hearing about the safe sleep, there's going to be people in your audience who are going to be moved by that, because of some connection that they have, where then the story doesn't become mine, it becomes ours. And when that happens, that's when you've got your audience. It's not the data, it's not the stats, it's not the PowerPoint, it's you, what you bring to the table and how you connect those stories. And you'll know, if you make a back of these stories, like I told you, you have a backup of all these stories, you'll know which ones fit for which crowds. And you'll be able to put those in as you need them, and they will work wonders for you because you'll connect in a way that no data could ever do.
Absolutely. You can tell the story from a perspective that people can connect with, that people can understand. You can connect with anybody. I could talk some stories all day about military things and use all the techno babble, where I use all the acronyms, all the things I talk about on a normal basis. And depending on my audience, they're either going to love it and we're going to be on the same wavelength, or they're going to hate it and be like, Travis, what on earth are you talking about? I didn't understand half of those words, and all of a sudden, I don't care either. Let's move on to the next topic. If you find yourself talking to a group of people and everyone looks like deer in the headlights staring back at you, you might tweak your speech for next time. Have yourself recorded. Go back and look. See where you stumbled. See what transitions you can use to make it flow better, and see if that techno babble exists and you're not speaking to your audience, you're speaking at them. And when you speak at them, you're going to lose them.
It's a conversation. That's the thing people have to understand. Just like what you and I are doing right now. When you are speaking, whether that's in a meeting or whether that's on a stage or whatever it may be, presentation, fundraising, whatever it may be, it is a conversation between people. And you've got to make it that way. You've got to get them pulled in. You've got to get them to understand, you're right. Lose the things that won't matter to them. Break it down, write it out, have at least some of it down. And let me show you something. See these? These are notes. Yes, I use notes. Not all the time, but when I do. During my TED talk, no notes at all. 18 minutes, no notes at all. But here's the thing. People think if you use notes, that's the reaction you often get is, oh my God, he uses notes. Alan Weiss is one of my all-time favorite speakers. You should look him up. He's a great, great speaker. And he was doing a speech one time, and he stops, walks over, takes his notes, and he does this and flips through. He comes back, and he's, yes, the guy, I get paid $25,000 for a keynote, and I use notes. Now, if the guy's getting paid $25,000 an hour and uses notes, you certainly can, but you have to understand something. Don't feel horrible about it. There's two things I want to give you on that. One, don't sit here and do this and read your notes. That's not what you want to do. But also understand the notes are not for you or for your audience. Why? Because you owe it to them for every bit of the time that you're taking from them, no matter how much time that is, 5 minutes or 5 hours. You owe them to give them your best. And if you have to have some notes to do that to make sure they get the material that you came there to give them, do it. Don't be afraid of it. And don't worry about what other people think about it. Just if you have to take a moment, compose yourself, walk over, sit down, take a second at your notes, get back over to your audience and continue, you're fine. Another little trick, you're talking about the ahs and the ums. You mind if I tell people how to break that real quick?
Go nuts. This is all about you. Go for it, Lewis.
All right. Here's the deal. Ahs and ums, those filler words that I call killer words that eat up so much time, there's a real simple way to fix it. I'm going to give that to you because I believe in giving value if I'm going to be doing something like this. It's called stop, drop, and pause. Much like stop, drop, and roll, you learned about when you catch on fire. Same thing gets in your head. When you hear it coming, people abhor silence. That's the problem. When they can't think of what they're going to think of next and say the correct thing, they, I need to do this because if I'm silent, it just drives you nuts. You hear it coming. You know you're going to say it. Stop. Just shut up. Don't say anything. Then drop the word. And if I may pull a little Star Trek thing out, be a Captain Kirk and pause. Why? Pausing does two things. It allows you to get back on track to what you're saying, and it gives the audience an opportunity to catch up with what you said. It also makes you look smart. If you've lost your place, if I'm talking to you and I lose my place, I may go, that way I look like I'm thinking about something, and people will go, what's about to come out of his mouth is profound. We better lean in on that one. But don't be afraid to pause. It's absolutely okay to pause. The audience is with you. They want you to win. But there is a simple fix for you out of all of this. You get a fix on how to start breaking that problem. And guys, let me tell you, once you start doing this, and Travis and I talked about this before we started recording, once you hear it, you cannot unhear it in your own voice and in other people. And you will wind up doing what I do. I make a tick sheet when people are talking. My wife elbows me during meetings. So stop it. Like, I can't help it. I have to count the number of ahs and ums that they had in something. And it's really amazing when you notice it about yourself. And if you stop doing it and everything else you do, every time you speak, guess what? It goes away whenever you're doing presentations, when you're doing sales, when you're doing fundraising. It just happens.
I get accused of being overconfident and cocky when I'm speaking to a group sometimes. And I ask them, like, why would you feel that way? And they say, you're just so powerful with the words that you use. And I'm like, look, I'm not confident on all these things that we're talking about today. But what I am confident about is the words that I'm going to be using. Whether or not they're right, I couldn't tell you. Whether or not the idea is crazy, I'm not signed on for that yet. But I've decided to speak every word that I say with confidence. And it's interesting you used the word profound a few minutes ago. Zig Ziglar says in his speeches, he's like, that's profound. And I always tell you when it's profound because I found that people don't tag along unless I let them know for sure that it is profound. So people really understand his point. I also heard about prep time. Like, how long does it take to prep a 5-minute speech or a 10-minute speech or a 30-second elevator speech? Is there any kind of lead time and how much prep work you should do for different length speeches?
No, because it's all various to the person. It depends on how complex of a topic you're trying to boil down. Is it something you can say pretty simply, or is it something you've really got to boil down? It varies for everybody, but I will tell you this. One of the key things I tell people in rehearsing is get off of your ass and on your feet. Why? Because your feet know more. And that sounds kind of silly when I say that, but if you sit down and you're writing your speech out or you're typing it out or whatever, and you sit at your computer screen or at a table and you read those words back, you think, I've got this down. Then when you get up and you start putting movement in with it and you start trying to imagine yourself in front of that crowd, what happens is you start trying to get off the notes because you've got the notes sitting off to the side. You start rehearsing, and your goal is not to look at the notes and try to remember everything you're going to say. And I've got all kinds of things in the course about how you can do that with some blocking and going into your rehearsal stuff and some memorization techniques. I've got all of that in there. But you want to get this down where you can be those would be short notes, not everything written out. It's not the whole speech on there. It's simply notes, exactly what it says, to keep you on track. When you rehearse like that, a weird thing happens, and I'm sure you bound to have had this happen. You'll be rehearsing something, and all of a sudden, a thought will come to you, and you'll go, wow, that'd be a good story to put in. I'm going to write that in there. You're going to start adding material in there that you wouldn't have thought of sitting in front of that computer screen. It's, remember when we were kids, and I don't know if you did this, Travis, if you admit to this, man, I'm probably going to just fall off camera laughing, but I'm guilty of it when I was a kid, stand in my bedroom and pretend I'm singing to an audience. All right. I did that. I don't know what fantasy you may have had. Maybe you're thinking you're an actor somewhere and you're doing a big scene and you're doing all of that. But I used to think I would be a singer someday and I'd stand in front of an audience and I'd sing and pretend that. It's the same thing when you rehearse. You want to pretend that audience is there. Pretend you can see them and you're talking to them and you're having this conversation with them, because the more realistic that is in your mind, the better it's going to be when you hit that moment, whether that's again in a meeting or on a stage where you're in front of these people. You get more relaxed and more comfortable. That becomes more natural to you. So in your rehearsal process, man, get up and move around. Get it in your head. Tie it to your body movements over and over and over. Prep time, if it's great for you and you can do it in 10 minutes, wonderful. If it takes you 2 weeks, wonderful. Whatever it takes for you to be able to do it, that's the amount of prep time you need.
I can't remember who mentioned this story. I don't know who these quotes are attributed to, and I definitely don't have the quote down pat. It goes something like this. If I have a 3-hour speech to give, I can get up and get it right now. We'll get through the points and the topics, no big deal. But if I only have 20 minutes, I'm going to put in 10 hours to make sure that 20 minutes is as succinct as possible. And if I only have 5 minutes, I'm going to spend all week making sure I maximize each and every second that I'm allotted. I don't know who that quote goes to. It's definitely not me, but it makes sense. You're in the limited compressed time and you only have a minute and a half on air. You better make every single word count, because those uhs and ums and likes are going to take away from your message.
They are. And I think that's actually, and I want to say, I don't know why, but for some reason, Grover Cleveland comes to mind. I don't know if it's actually him, but it was a presidential statement, I believe. President or a senator. I remember hearing that statement too. And you're right. The shorter the speech is, the more prep time it takes to do it, because that's when it really gets down to it, particularly if you're going to be on television. If you're doing an interview, whether that's live, or a Facebook Live, or you're doing something on Zoom with people and they're giving you an opportunity to speak for a few minutes, or if you belong to a group like a BNI group or something where you have to stand up and in 2 minutes tell your story. You're at a Chamber of Commerce, you have to stand up and give your 2 minutes and tell your story. That's when you really need to make sure every single word counts. You're 1,000% right on that.
I love this episode, Lewis. I think we've got great tips from start to finish and everything in between. I know I mentioned earlier that people can get a hold of you at gettothedamnpoint.com, but where else can they find you?
That's the biggest spot right now. I'm in the process of building up the social media. I do have a Facebook site we're going to be putting out there pretty soon, but the website is the biggest place right now to find what they're looking for. They'll find the ebook on there. They'll find my why. You'll find a link to the TED Talk if you'd like to take a look at that. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me there, but the primary source right now is to go to the website.
Fantastic, Lewis. Thank you so much for being on the show. And reach out to Lewis if you've got questions about it. If you want to buy his program, buy his program. If you want to contact him and you've got questions, ask him. Closed mouths don't get offended. He has no idea if you need help if you don't ask him.
One more quick thing I want to throw out there, if you don't mind, Travis. For the nonprofits that are listening, here's the thing, guys. I did this course. And when you look at the price of it, don't get sticker shock. What I want you to understand is for the nonprofits who contact me, who are true 501c3s, contact me. What I'm doing is for that price that you see, you're going to get to train 3 people. I'm going to reduce that down to where you buy it and you get 3 people you can put into it. So I want to make this to where it's affordable. And I can tell you, Travis and I talked about this, bringing in consultants to wherever you are. I'm in Kentucky. With COVID going on, you don't want me coming into your workplace. This is a perfect opportunity for you to have to be able to sit down in your own time at your own pace and learn this material. And it's 4.5 hours worth. It's something that's easily digestible. Each segment's only 5 minutes long on average. Check it out. Get a hold of me. I'm going to make you a sweet, sweet deal, because guys, I want to help the helpers help others. That's what I want to do.
What a great way to end the show. Thank you so much, Lewis. Thanks for being on today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.